From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Pete Townshend of The Who turns 55 today. This summer, the surviving members of The Who will reunite for a tour. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll feature a 1993 interview with Townshend. Also, we remember film director, screenwriter, and actor Paul Bartel. He died Saturday at the age of 61. He's best known for his bad taste comedies and social satires like Eating Raoul and scenes from the class struggle in Beverly Hills. He co-starred in the film Rock and Roll High School. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new CDs by Elliot Smith and Jewel Shear, and film critic John Powers reviews Croupier, which he says is the best film he's seen this year. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Representative Rick Lazio says he'll enter the U.S. Senate race in New York against Hillary Rodham Clinton. Lazio declared his candidacy shortly after New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani abandoned his campaign, beset by prostate cancer and the apparent collapse of his marriage. Lazio, a Republican from Long Island, began a Senate bid last year, but suspended it after Governor George Pataki asked him to step aside in favor of Giuliani, who had better name recognition. An internal report by the Justice Department faults the FBI for the way it handled a major espionage investigation involving China. NPR's Barbara Bradley reports.
The four-volume review reportedly describes a series of lapses by the FBI and the Justice Department when they investigated Wen-Ho Lee, formerly a nuclear scientist at Los Alamos National Laboratory. Senator Arlen Specter chairs one special committee investigating the government's performance, and he's peeved that the Justice Department won't release the details.
I requested the report, but was turned down by the Department of Justice, and next week I'm going to ask the full Judiciary Committee to issue a subpoena so that we can get it as promptly as possible.
Among the criticisms that the FBI moved too slowly on Lee, and when it did, it focused exclusively on him, ignoring other possible suspects. Also, the document allegedly criticizes the Department of Justice for failing to issue a secret search warrant of Lee's computer. Barbara Bradley, NPR News, Washington.
American peacekeepers in Kosovo seized a weapons cache today in a village populated mainly by ethnic Albanians. NATO officials said around 250 U.S. soldiers took part in the operation, confiscating rifles, explosives, hand grenades, and a rocket launcher. They arrested five people. The punishment phase in the trial of the so-called railroad killer continued today in Houston as family members of some of the murder victims testify for the prosecution. Paul Pendergraf reports from member station KUHF.
The brother of one of the eight victims believed to have been killed by Angel Matarena Resendiz described to the jury of finding his sister's bloody body beneath a pile of laundry in her Houston home last June. Also scheduled to testify is the only known survivor of one of the attacks, a college student from Kentucky whose boyfriend was killed by Resendiz. The rail car riding drifter admitted to these crimes in his trial and was convicted of capital murder yesterday. After being found guilty, Matarena Resendiz told the judge that he wanted to be executed and instructed his attorneys not to mount a defense in the punishment phase nor file an appeal. Prosecutors are asking for the death penalty. Testimony in the punishment phase is expected to continue into next week. For NPR News, I'm Paul Pendergraft in Houston.
The Dow lost 150 points today to close at 10,627 in active trading. This is NPR. After three launch delays, the space shuttle Atlantis took off this morning on a mission to repair and maintain the International Space Station. As soon as the shuttle was safely in orbit, the astronauts opened the payload door to prepare for their mission. They're scheduled to dock with the space station on Sunday. The crew will replace the station's failing batteries and raise the modules to a higher orbit. The United Nations Refugee Agency reports thousands of Eritreans are fleeing to neighboring Sudan. They're escaping renewed fighting with Ethiopia. The UN estimates as many as 20,000 refugees crossed into Sudan just yesterday. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
UN aid workers are directing new arrivals to 12 camps in the area, which already house 160,000 Eritrean refugees from a previous war. UN refugee spokesman Ron Redmond says among the new arrivals are Eritrean soldiers who are being disarmed by the Sudanese army.
UNHCR staff and humanitarian assistance, both food and non-food items, had already been pre-positioned along that border.
Meanwhile, the World Food Program is appealing for $12 million to help some 330,000 people inside Eritrea who've been made homeless by the war. The agency plans to fly supplies into the region this weekend. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Schlein in Geneva.
Costly foreign oil imports helped drive the U.S. trade deficit to a record high of more than $30 billion in March. The Commerce Department said the overall deficit grew by more than 5% from February, despite an upsurge in exports of American farm products and automobiles. U.S. exports rose by nearly 3% in March. This is NPR.
Support for National Public Radio comes from Rhythms, offering high-speed DSL internet connections for home and business. Online at rhythms.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today is the 55th birthday of Pete Townsend, the co-founder, guitarist, and main songwriter of The Who. The surviving members of The Who are reuniting for a summer tour, which will begin in Chicago on June 25th. The Who was founded in 1964 in London and soon became a voice of teenage rebellion with anthems like Townsend's song, My Generation. This song has his most famous line, "Hope I die before I get old."
People try to put us to down,
talking about my generation,
just because we get around,
talking about my generation.
Things they do look awful. Before I get old,
talking about my generation,
take my generation, baby. Why don't you all fade away? Don't try to dig what we all say. I'm not trying to cause a big sensation. I'm just talking about my generation.
Townsend's rebellious energy was expressed not only in his songs, but in his power chords and in the way he'd smash his guitar at the end of his concerts. Even people who don't know much about The Who are aware of their rock opera Tommy, about the deaf, dumb, and blind kid who became a pinball wizard. The 1969 album later became a Ken Russell film and a Broadway hit. On this archive edition, we have a 1993 interview with Townsend, recorded after he broke his wrist in a bicycle accident, which left him temporarily unable to play.
The wrist injury was a life-changing thing for me. It changed a whole lot of things. And because it was so, in the short term, immediately after the accident, it was so devastating, I couldn't write, I couldn't type, I certainly couldn't play any musical instrument, and it was a very, very complicated fracture, and I had no idea whether physiotherapy was going to get what kind of movement I was going to get back, and all the signs were that it was going to be a long, drawn out process of maybe 5 years with maybe three or four operations, So I was kind of looking at, you know, and I suppose in a way I was already in semi-retirement. I had a career as a solo artist, but, you know, I didn't, you know, it's not something that takes up an immense amount of time. I just had time to stop and look at what was happening in my life and who I was and who I wanted to be and, you know, how much I really cared about not being able to play and how much I really cared about not being able to write.
So when you hurt your arm and you say you asked yourself how much you cared about not being able to play, how much did you care?
I didn't care very much. I really didn't. I think it was really quite sobering in a way to realize that. I thought I was going to miss being able to sit around with a guitar and entertain myself. But I immediately started to learn to write longhand with my left hand. And by the time my right hand started to work, I was almost completely left-handed.
Hmm.
Take something away from somebody and it makes you revalue everything else that you've got. And I think that's what I did. So, no, I'm not trying to be callous or hard or indifferent to my talent. But that was the space I was in. I was kind of in a space where I wasn't really worrying so much about what I'd lost, but I was very interested in what I'd gained. And I had a very clear list of things to do, 100 things to do, you know, while you can't play the guitar. And one of the things at the very, very bottom of the list, and I managed to actually get through this list in about a week. One of the things at the bottom of the list was go and see Mum, my mother, and ask her about the lost years.
The lost years?
The lost years.
The years when you were with your grandparents?
Yeah.
Well, it was your parents were on the road, I think. Your father was a musician.
Yeah.
And well, you spent, when you were about 5 to 7, you were with your grandparents.
That's right. Not with my grandparents. I was with my grandmother, who was a single woman. Mm-hmm. She actually deserted my mother when she was married.
Why was it so important to you to feel? What did you need to know about that?
Well,
time?
I couldn't remember. I couldn't remember anything, and I couldn't remember very much about those years. All I could remember was really quite unpleasant things, and I wanted to know. So I went to see my mother, and I said, "Listen, don't give me any details. Don't give me any stuff. Don't give me any emotion. Just give me facts. I want to know where I was on, you know, June 1st, where I was on June 2nd, and because I said, you know, let me. Digest that, and then I'll come back later and ask you about the emotional stuff, the personal stuff, and the reasons. And whenever she did, I ran a tape machine, and whenever she digressed, I got her back on track and said, "No, listen, just stick to the facts and help me, because you know." And so, a lot of the stuff was fairly fresh in her mind, but.
So, did this were there revelations for you in what she told you?
Yeah. I mean, shocking revelations.
Like what? I don't know if you'd care to share them or not.
I can't really share them.
That's fine.
But what I realized was is that some of the memories that I did have of my childhood that stopped, you know, where you know you kind of go into a dark tunnel and you can't see what's at the other end of a memory. I'd actually remembered them in my work, that my writing was the memory that still functioned. You know, I've even been in therapy and, confronted or come to that point where I've actually tried to, you know, remember that stuff. And my therapist once said to me, I'm not in therapy anymore, I did it for 3 years. Write it down, you know, write down what happened. And when you come to the point that you can't remember, just keep writing. And when I sat down to start writing, I started to get this incredible feeling of dread. And it was so enormous that I just broke down, and I realized that if I continued to try to remember, I would actually have a kind of nervous breakdown, and decided not to go on. You know, and I don't think, and what's interesting is just so that people don't think this is the Oprah Winfrey show. the reason why I can't talk about what happened is that I don't think it's particularly significant. Comparison to the terrible, terrible things that have happened to people that I know and that people that I read about. But its effect on me was enormous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't mean to suggest deep, dark secrets necessarily.
Right.
A curious kind of, you know, definitely a curious byproduct of being the child of not only two very young people who were born in the war, met in the war and married in the Air Force. And you know, my father was very glamorous, wonderful looking, looked like a film star. My mother was a very sexy, well-dressed young girl. And you know, that I think, you know, I came along very, very quickly. I think my mother, you know, conceived me like within about a week of their marriage. And there I was, you know, and I think, you know, he was out on the road, still young, having fun. And my mother had been a singer in a band, and I think she just wanted some time to herself. So she hung with me for about 2.5-3 years. And they were such fantastic years. You know, I was out on the road with my mum and dad, and I was with them all the time. And I used to sleep in between them. You know, I was in the way. I was there. I was the star of the show. I was on the stage. I can remember show business. And then it just goes black.
Well, how did show business look to you when you were young and your parents were on the road? Was that the kind of life you thought you might want for yourself sometime?
Oh, there was no question. That was what I was going to do.
That's what you wanted.
Yeah, no, it wasn't what I wanted. It's what I had. It was where I was. It's like, you know, this is Liza Minnelli and Lorna Luft, you know, except that for me, it was both mum and dad there all the time. And this extended family, it's a big dance orchestra, you know, with like 26 members.
But your father played clarinet?
Clarinet and saxophone, yeah.
And your mother sang?
Yeah, yeah.
No, before rock, and before you seriously took up guitar, you liked trad jazz, and I think you even played banjo before you got serious about the guitar. What did you prefer about jazz during the period that you were into that and didn't listen to that much rock?
Oh, this is a neat conjunction. It was the fact that it connected more with my father and the kind of music that he played. The band used to play a Dixieland set in the show, which was very popular when I was a teenager. This is my father's band.
Mm-hmm.
It was a concession to the young people, you know, the crazy young people who like that jazz stuff, because most of it was ballroom dancing.
Uh-huh.
So this was a sort of 20-minute set, and my father played lead clarinet, and I used to love that because this seemed to me to be, you know, where, this was pre my discovery of rock and roll. And had I been exposed, you know, to, I don't know, John Lee Hooker or Hank Williams or any of those kind of early, or even Pete Seeger or any of those people that were kind of defining how the song was going to become a rock song, and, you know, how the song of those three different distinct forms of popular music would come together as the rock song 10 years later, if I'd have heard that music, I don't know whether I would have responded to it at all. I had no context for it. So I think, you know, the trad jazz thing was just what, you know, it was something that grew out of my need to mm-hmm. do something that connected with my dad, who I worshipped.
My guest is Pete Townsend. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Pete Townsend, the co-founder of The Who, turned 55 today. The surviving members of the band are reuniting for a summer tour. Let's get back to our 1993 interview with Townsend. Now, let me ask you about the beginnings of your music. Having come to rock and roll after being interested in jazz, after having played guitar, after having worshipped your father who played clarinet, when you started playing rock and roll, you really cranked up the volume and started using feedback and distortion, getting really far away from the sounds you were first interested in. Tell me why you became so interested in volume and distortion.
Well, there are a couple of different things. I mean, there's a sort of a sociologist in me on this subject, and I think that, and if I can actually talk about Jim Marshall as an example here, I won't talk about me. Let me talk about Jim Marshall. Jim Marshall's father was a boxer. Jim Marshall is the man who invented the Marshall amplifier, you know, the big stack that the Who used, that mm-hmm. Eric Clapton used, that Jimi Hendrix adopted when he came to the UK, that big wall of sound thing. And Jim had a music shop, and one day I went in, and we'd been playing at pubs, and I said, I've got these two American amplifiers, Jim. I've got a Fender Pro Amp and a Fender Bassman Amp, and I said, they're great amplifiers, they sound great. And I was already using a certain amount of feedback. And I said, but the trouble is that I can hear the audience. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, I can hear them. You know, I mean, if I'm playing and somebody's in the front row and they say, this is junk, I can hear what they're saying. I don't want to hear them, okay? And I said, so I need something bigger and louder. And his eyes lit up. And I said, can you do this for me? And he said, and he got his engineer out and he said, do you think you can do this? And the guy said, yeah, I think I can do it. You know, I can do it. I think I can do it. And I realized at that moment that what was actually happening was that I was demanding a more powerful machine gun. And Jim Marshall was going to build it for me. And then we were going to go out and blow people away all around the world, and the generation we were going to blow away was the generation immediately preceding us, the ones who had the gall to tell us that we were wimps because we had long hair, wimps because we didn't have wars to fight in, wimps because we couldn't prove ourselves in military service because we didn't have it, you know, it was not necessary anymore. We were post-atomic bomb people, that we were wimps, 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 and that the only reason that we even had electric guitars and rock and roll was because they'd paved the way for peace and given everything up, which is, of course, absolutely true, they had. You know, and Remembrance Day is a day that I take very seriously. You know, I do remember those guys that gave us this peace, and I don't, you know, I don't, I cry for them. But I think that anger was something that really crossed over generations. It wasn't just from rock and roll. It just wasn't from me and my need to smash guitars. It was right over the whole industry, right through the whole of show business and rock and roll and the media and everybody. Everybody of that generation wanted it to be bigger, louder, and wanted it to be as big as the atomic bomb had been.
Now, how do you connect this to smashing guitars?
I think the connection isn't actually, you would call it in CD-ROM talk, you would call it a hyperlink. I don't think it's a direct connection. Mm-hmm. I think it was a byproduct of stage performance. I think, you know, that you know, the first guitar that I broke in front of my grandmother, when I was 14.
Were you impressing her, or was this a mistake?
No. It was another take on the Jim Marshall story. She bought me my first guitar, which was a piece of trash. Uh-huh. And I was very upset because my father had recommended the guitar because I couldn't play the clarinet, and I wanted him to buy the guitar. So I was angry that she bought me this piece of trash, and it was very, very hard to play. And my dad said, well, you know, she has bought it for you. She is your grandmother. Try and learn to play something on it. And if you can, then I'll buy you a new one. And this went on and on and on and on. And one day I'm clunking away at this horrible kind of guitar, which was really fit only to be hung on the wall at an Italian restaurant next to the Chianti bottles. And I think that's where it probably came from. And she came in and she said, this is a bloody awful row, you know, why don't you play some proper music? And I said, listen, Nan, we know what we're doing, you know, leave us alone. And I was with John Entwistle, who was, you know, we were little kids, really. And she said, no, turn it off, it's a bloody horrible row. So, and she said, if you don't turn it off, I'll smash it. So I said, no, you won't smash it. And I got the guitar, and I smashed it over the amplifier. I broke an amplifier at the same time too, a little kind of tiny amplifier, and she went completely white and walked out of the room. And John said, "You've done it now," and I said, "I might have." I said, "But John, I feel great." And of course, I was able then to go and look for a decent guitar and rob and steal to get it, which is what I did. And I found myself a decent instrument. And from there on, I never looked back, really.
Yeah, but once you had a good instrument, why did you smash that on stage?
Guitars are very good for me to express myself by smashing them.
Mm-hmm.
They're very good for me to express myself by playing them. They're very good for express myself by pouring lighter fluid over them and warming my hands. You know, it depends what I'm doing. You know.
But let me ask you, how did the feeling you had the first time you smashed a guitar on stage compare to the feeling you had like the 100th time or the 200th time you'd done it? Did it still feel as good? Did it feel good in a different way?
I don't think it's ever felt good at all. I don't think it's something that I expected to feel good.
I mean, good in the sense of a release.
I don't think it's ever felt good as a sense of a release. I don't, you know, I'm afraid it's too, it's always been too, you know, I've always used the instrument that I happen to be playing at the time, and I mean, as I see it splinter, I'm thinking, oh my God, $1,000. But you know, I've actually been enough of an artist and believed in the act enough to do it again and again and again.
Well, what does the act mean to you?
It means a number of things. I think it's a statement mainly of artistic independence. I mean, it's also an act of, It's in the same tone as, you know, as you know, we want our amplifiers to be loud so that we can't hear the response. It's like saying, okay, the show is over now. I am finished. And in a sense, that all music is over now. Everything to do with this particular event is over now. It's finished. You know, the interaction between me, you, and this guitar is over now. It's a big, dramatic action. And the reason that it has to, in a way, be theatrically violent, because I think that's as far as it gets. It's, you know, we used to smash our equipment off up and then go back and drink, you know, cups of lemon tea. Like, I think that the reason that it needs to be theatrically violent is in a way that it is because the observation that the thing that we're trying, you know, get out of the you know to the response that we want from the audience is one of absolute reflection at that moment on everything that's happened up to that point. You know, to stun them, to actually stop them.
Well, I really wish we had more time to talk, but we have to wrap up. It's really been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
For being with us.
Pete Townsend recorded in 1993. Today is his 55th birthday. The surviving members of The Who will reunite for a summer tour that begins June 25th. Townsend's new CD, Lifehouse Elements, will be released next week. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From World Wildlife Fund, known by its panda logo, working in more than 100 countries around the globe to leave our children a living planet. On the web, worldwildlife.org. From Random House Incorporated, Bantam Books Division, publisher of Flags of Our Fathers by James Bradley with Ron Powers, the story of the men who raised the flag on Iwo Jima. And from Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we remember film director, screenwriter, and actor Paul Bartel. He died on Saturday at the age of 61. His social satires included Eating Raoul and scenes from the class struggle in Beverly Hills. Also, Ken Tucker reviews new CDs by singer-songwriters Elliot Smith and Jules Shear, and film critic John Powers reviews Croupier. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Elliott Smith emerged from cult status a couple of years ago when one of his songs from the soundtrack to Good Will Hunting was nominated for an Oscar. He has a new CD called Figure Eight, which is getting rave reviews. Our rock critic Ken Tucker listened to it and finds similarities to an older, now less fashionable singer-songwriter, Jules Shear, who also has a new CD. Here's Ken's review of both.
Tender feelings that you made hard, but it's your heart, not mine, that's scarred. So when I go home, I'll be happy to go. You're just somebody that I used to know.
Elliott Smith, with his wimpy voice and iron-willed sentiments, is very much in favor in rock press circles these days. A new song like that one, called Somebody That I Used to Know, can be praised for the way its pretty melody and delicately sung vocal contrasts dramatically with the angry dismissal of its lyrics. It's a formula that Smith uses to good effect throughout his CD, Figure Eight, as on this pretty bit of despair, Everything Means Nothing to Me.
Someone found the future as a statue in a fountain, and attention looking backward in a pool of water. Wishes with a blue songbird on his shoulder, who keeps singing over everything. Everything means nothing to me. Everything means nothing to me. Everything means nothing to me.
In reviews of Figure Eight, Elliott Smith is being compared to the Beatles and dubbed the Brian Wilson of grunge. All pretty meaningless, but nonetheless redolent of high praise. I remember trying to hype a somewhat similar artist in similar terms almost two decades ago, when Jules Shear was leading a Los Angeles rock band called Jules and the Polar Bears. As you can hear on Shear's brand new solo album called Allow Me, Elliott Smith has nothing on Shear when it comes to passion empowered by whininess.
The bright and chilly morning sneaks up my shirt cuffs. I see it drinking coffee, looking pretty rough. You sit around with your best friends, cigarettes and caffeine. But you neglect to mention you're your own worst enemy. You don't have to beat yourself up to live. It's hard enough.
When I accuse Jules Shear of whininess, I do it as an affectionate joke. In fact, I love his singing. It's my favorite kind of rock vocalizing, in which the technical limitations of the singer actually enhance the pure emotions he's trying to put across. Plus, Shear has a knack for catchy melodies that a comparative kid like Elliott Smith ought to envy. Just listen to Shear's The More That I'm Around You. While Elliott Smith can eloquently dismiss a lover as somebody that I used to know and press upon you the implication that he rejected her, Jules Shear knows that the heart and soul of the best whiny rock is to candidly admit that she has rejected you, and he bemoans his dumped status by reiterating his devotion.
Day and night, I'm in love with you.
If I've been harder on Elliot Smith than Jules Shear here, it's just that I know Shear's CD is never going to get the attention that Smith's already has. Shear has been around too long to be a hit media fave. In the end, I think it'll all even out. The majority of record buyers go for guys with better voices than either of these men. But for now, I'm pulling for the underdog. For anyone who reads a rave Elliot Smith review, I urge you to go out and buy Shear's Allow Me. After all, Jules Shear wrote the best song the Bangles ever recorded, If She Knew What She Wants. The new millennium equivalent would be Elliot Smith writing good material for Britney Spears. Fat chance of that.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Figure Eight by Elliot Smith and Allow Me by Jules Shear. Here's Shear singing his song If She Knew What She Wants from an earlier CD.
If she knew what she wants, if she knew what she needs, if she knew what she wants, if she knew what she wants, I'd be giving it to her, giving it to her. But she wants everything. There's nothing she wants. I'm crazy for this girl. If she knew what she wants, I'd be giving it to her, giving it to her. Now I'd say her values aren't corrupted and she's open to change. But one day she's satisfied and the next I find her crying and it's nothing she can explain. If she knew what she wants, if she knew.
Coming up, films that specialized in bad taste and social satire. We remember screenwriter, director, and actor Paul Bartel. He died Saturday at the age of 61. This is Fresh Air. We're going to remember screenwriter, actor, and director Paul Bartel. He died Saturday at the age of 61, 2 weeks after undergoing surgery for cancer of the liver ducts. No one with a decent respect for bad taste will want to miss Paul Bartel's new movie, wrote critic Stuart Klawans after the 1989 release of Bartel's social satire, Scenes from the Class Struggle in Beverly Hills, which Bartel wrote, directed, and co-starred in. The bad taste in that story was nothing compared to his 1982 cult film, Eating Raoul. Many people will know Bartel from his role in the 1979 movie Rock and Roll High School, in which he played a square teacher.
Ludwig van Beethoven, whom you will be interested to learn, wrote his greatest symphony at a time when he was completely deaf, a feat which was practically unheard of at the time. I know that most of you are used to listening to a very different kind of music, but I hope that when you hear the immortal strains of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, you will realize what a work of genius it really is. I seem to have misplaced the turntable.
Paul Bartel got his start in Hollywood working for the king of B-movies, Roger Corman, directing such action films as Cannonball and Death Race 2000. You can see him in the new movie Hamlet in the role of Osric. I spoke with Bartel in 1989.
The tastelessness in your movies is rude but not revolting, if you know what I mean. It never gets like terribly explicit or graphic. Can you talk about the kinds of tastelessness that interest you most?
Well, I would never refer to the things that I do as tasteless. I think taste is a spectrum, And actually what I try to accomplish is a kind of contradiction. I try to take subject matter that is likely to offend or upset people in the abstract and treat it as tactfully and as discreetly as possible so that they are induced to laugh at it at the same time that they're gasping.
What are the things that you really have to work at getting right in terms of tone and timing to achieve that effect?
Well, of course, the principal thing in a motion picture is the visual image. And even while people are preparing to do shocking things, I try to keep the image as discreet as possible.
Now, in your movies, you usually play people who are refined and inhibited on the surface, but kind of perverse underneath. And I was wondering if you see an element of that in yourself, or what it is in yourself or in your acting that leads you to write characters like that for you to play.
I find it very unproductive to be too analytical about my own persona and the parts that I play. I follow my instincts. If it makes me laugh when I see it on the screen, then I'm satisfied.
Now, you got your start in movies, or at least one of the things that helped you get started in movies was working for Roger Corman. Now, for him, you directed exploitation movies, action movies. Now, does that fit in with your image of yourself at all?
No. In fact, the element that I contributed to the most successful of the films that I made for Roger, which was Death Race 2000, was black humor. I'm afraid that that the action in that film, while there were some nice action sequences, was not really, that was all there in the script and in the storyboard, and all I had to do was execute it. So I didn't feel that I could take much, or I don't feel that I can take much credit for that. But it was some of the jokes and some of the comic notions in the film. I think some of the jokes may have gone over Roger Corman's head, and I think he resented a certain amount of the humor that went into it. He kept vacillating between the feeling that he wanted a hard action film and wanting a sophisticated comedy, and he would go back and forth. And I knew what I wanted, and I just stuck to my guns and put as much comedy into it as possible. In my cut of the film, there was no blood at all. He added a lot of crushed heads and splattering blood.
Did you give yourself any cameos in the movies you directed for Corman?
In my very first feature film, which was done for Roger's brother, Gene Corman, I played a silent cameo of a bum that stumbles out from behind a tree in the park. It was about a 5-second appearance, I would say. Mm-hmm. In my second feature, which was Death Race 2000, I gave myself about 5 lines. I played the surgeon who wheels David Carradine in on a gurney, just having been put back together, and I announced to the press that he was ready to race again.
So you never graduated from the Corman Studios to become a big action film director yourself. Instead, you went a completely different route. You ended up writing, producing, and directing your own movies. How did you end up taking that direction?
After Cannonball was released, I went through a period of 5 years where I worked on projects that never quite made it to the screen. I did appear in a number of films as an actor that did make it to the screen. But during this 5-year period, I was hired to write scripts, to supervise other people writing scripts, which I was supposed eventually to direct. And none of them were fully financed or could be cast to the satisfaction of the studio. All of them fell apart for one reason or another. And towards the end of the 5 years, I really started getting desperate. I knew I wanted to make a film that was very personal, but I also wanted to make something that was commercial. And I thought that if I could come up with a funny idea that was based on the elements of sex and violence, which were the two cornerstones of the Corman empire, that I could probably get Roger to back the project. So together with my friend Dick Blackburn, I hatched the idea for Eating Raoul. At first, we had discussed writing a film in which Mary and I would play detectives. And then we decided that that was probably a cliched idea that had already been overexposed on television. And instead of detectives, we went to the opposite extreme and made ourselves murderers.
So the premise of the story was that you and Mary Warrenoff play a put-upon middle-class couple who decide to lure swingers to your apartment through ads in the sex magazines, and then you rob and kill them.
Right. And in order to get the money for our little country kitchen.
Right.
The idea in a single line is that we play a couple that are so upset with with Los Angeles that in order to get away from the violence and sexuality of life in Los Angeles, we become we embark on a career of sex murders.
Right. In order to get away from all the filth. All right.
Right.
Do you realize that we have made almost $1,000 in 2 days, tax-free?
Just by killing people.
Horrible sex-crazed maniacs that nobody in the world would miss. I wonder how much we could make if we really put our minds to it.
What do you mean?
The city is full of rich perverts. If somehow we could get them to come to the apartment...
But Barry, why would they? We'd have to lure them with...
sex.
But you wouldn't really have to... I mean, you wouldn't actually do anything.
Of course not. The minute they try anything dirty, you pop them in the head and get rid of them like you did with this guy.
But Mary, how would we contact them? We don't know anything about this swinger business.
As someone who does.
All of them read this?
Isn't there something a little more
classier? Nope. This paper covers the field from the richest to the poorest. If they're kinky, they read the Hollywood Press.
This scenario provides great opportunities for showing the absurdity, for mocking S&M costumes and S&M theater. I think you have a really good time with that.
Yes, all of the little... sex fetishes that people seem to become so attached to in this town, the Nazi fetish, the leather and chain fetish, and even some that we invented, the little boy fetish. We took a very sort of cloddish middle class approach to all these fetishes, and somehow the synthesis of that point of view for our characters and the sophistication of what they were trying to do resulted in laughs.
You and your wife star in your movies.
Well, she's not my wife.
She's not your wife?
No,
she's just
a good friend.
Oh.
She's only my wife in the movies.
Gosh, I really thought you were married.
No.
That means you're not lovers either?
No, I'm gay and she's a painter.
Gosh, that's really funny. I thought you were a couple.
Well, we are a couple, but
a different
we're
kind
not
of couple,
that kind
right?
Of a couple.
So I won't ask you about what it's like to direct her having affairs with Robert Beltran in movies.
No, you should ask me if I'd had an affair with Robert Beltran.
That's right. Well, did you?
Well, I wish I could say I had, but I haven't.
I have never been able to figure out how you can direct yourself in a movie. I mean, how a director can also star in the film. You managed to do that. Well, can you give me a sense of what the tricks are to making that work?
It's the same way that Dumbo is able to fly. If you believe you can do it, you can.
All right, I'll accept that as a highly analytical answer.
Well, as I was saying before, you know, I was telling you that I started out doing a silent bit in my first picture, and then I did five lines in my second, and I built up. Each picture I've given myself a larger role until in Eating Raoul I thought, what the hell? I'm risking my own money. This is all being done by me and my friends. Why shouldn't Mary and I play the leads? And we did, and it worked out.
As an independent director and actor and writer, I think you've stayed so far in a way on the periphery of the commercial film industry, as opposed to right in the middle, right in the mainstream of it. Is it your intention to stay there, or are you trying to work your way into the center?
I have nothing against the commercial film industry, and I have often been involved with commercial, you know, big studio films as an actor, and a lot of my friends have directed them, and I would be happy to direct a film for a big studio. I did, in fact, direct a film for Orion a couple of years back, a Tim Conway comedy called The Long Shot. But about 10 years ago, I sort of had a talk with myself and decided that rather than try to become a commercial director, one of the directors that studios hire to do the big commercial projects that they develop, that I would much prefer being an independent producer, director, with my own, you know, sort of specialized style, somewhat limited audience, but more intense identity. I would prefer to be an artist to whatever degree I have the right to claim that identity than a maker of commercial products.
Paul Bartel, recorded in 1989. He died Saturday at the age of 61. Coming up, John Powers reviews the new movie Croupier. This is Fresh Air. Earlier this week, we heard from the writer and the director of Croupier, a British film that recently opened in U.S. theaters. How good is it? Here's our film critic, John Powers.
A few weeks ago, a friend in D.C. sent me an email ordering me to see Croupier, a small English movie that had arrived in the U.S. with little fanfare and almost no advertising money behind it. He told me it was clearly the best film of the year. When Croupier reached L.A., I dutifully went to see it. And now it's my turn to order you to see it. For this smart, funny, surprising thriller really is the best movie I've seen this year. The fine English actor Clive Owen stars as Jack Manfred, a struggling writer with bleached hair and a loving girlfriend. In earlier days, Jack had worked as a croupier in South Africa, but he's been trying to escape life in what he calls the, quote, house of addiction, both the addiction of the gamblers to losing and the croupier's addiction to taking the sucker's money. But in desperate need of cash, he lets his crooked dad get him a job at a London casino. Jack falls into full croupier mode, and before you can say noir, he's involved in a labyrinthine plot involving grifters, hookers, killers, and a mysterious South African woman, played by ER's Alex Kingston. But he's up to more than simply living out a story of violence and betrayal. He's also fashioning his experiences into a book, wittily titled I, Croupier. Jack tells us all this in one of the most seductive voiceover narrations I've heard in a movie. He grabs us from the opening scene when he stands at a roulette table as the little ball of fortune spins around the wheel.
Now he had become the still center of that spinning wheel of misfortune. The world turned round him, leaving him miraculously untouched. The croupier had reached his goal. He no longer heard the sound of the ball.
Croupier marks an extraordinary comeback for the veteran team that made it, writer Paul Mayersberg and director Mike Hodges, both of whom had all but vanished in recent years. A superb stylist, Hodges is still best known for movies like the 1971 gangster picture Get Carter, where he showed his ability to capture the rattiness of the English underworld. And he does the same here, neatly creating a deglamorized demimonde in which mysterious women aren't especially good-looking, small-time crooks are loutish and dull, and gambling seems dingy, not alluring. Carefully establishing the rituals of the croupier life, he anchors Jack's story in a world that feels real. But is it? Screenwriter Mayersberg is probably best known for writing The Man Who Fell to Earth 24 years ago, and some of that film's eerie sense of dislocation pervades Croupier. Not only is Jack's voiceover narration perfectly woven into the story, It plays off the action rather than merely commenting on it, but it also establishes Jack's status as a kind of double agent. He's a man who lives inside and outside his own story at the same time. And it's one measure of Clive Owen's extraordinary performance that he manages at once to suggest exactly that mixture of expressiveness and detachment. He plays virtually every scene on at least two levels, as the croupier caught up in the action and the writer turning it into a story. In fact, these two levels are actually playing leapfrog with one another. For at bottom, Croupier isn't just a straightforward thriller about an ordinary croupier. It's a highly self-conscious riff on the idea of storytelling, in the tradition of Nabokov's Pale Fire or Dennis Potter's The Singing Detective. The movie's all about the way that Jack the detached croupier, who services the fantasies of gamblers, is like Jack the storyteller, who services our fantasies as his audience. We make our bets on what will happen, dislike the idea that some of the plot twists seem like a matter of chance, and we desperately want it to all add up. Just like gamblers, we want to walk away as winners, carrying with us the chips of some neat meaning. What makes the movie so satisfying is that Meyersburg and Hodges never make us feel that we're watching an intellectual art film. Instead, they give us a terrifically gripping thriller that pulls us in so neatly that it's easy not to notice that the deck has been stacked against us all along.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Alcatel, providing integrated voice and data networks for the internet, enterprises, and carriers worldwide. At www.alcatel.com. From Random House's Crown Publishers Division, hardcover publishers of Patient Number One, a true story of how one CEO took on cancer and big business in the fight of his life, by Rick Murdoch and David Fisher. And from Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actress Tracy Ullman. She's starring in the new Woody Allen movie, Small Time Crooks. Also, how former Chicago Mayor Richard J. Daley rebuilt the city in a way that virtually ensured it would be segregated. Daley is the subject of the new book, American Pharaoh. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.